You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with comedian, actor, and all-around funny man, Martin Short. Martin Short grew up in a family full of funny people. He staged make-believe talk shows in his attic and absorbed a steady diet of comedy masters like Carson, Rickles, and Parr, and yet inexplicably dreamed of becoming a doctor or a dentist. Always serious about success, Short gave himself a one-year contract to make it in comedy before returning to school for a master's degree in a respectable medical field. Though we all know how things worked out, it's rare to find a budding comic with a backup plan. But Short is a rare comedian, one you'd both want to go out and have a drink with, and who you would allow to babysit your kids. Maybe due to his upbringing as the adored baby of a family who never discouraged his comic pursuits, Short developed a self-assurance uncommon to the standard performer's psyche. But it's as hard-earned as it is innate. Short prepares. He practices in mirrors. He plots sketches with index cards. He does his homework. He knows his audience. And when it comes to talk shows, he knows his hosts. He's an encyclopedia of the style nuances of everyone from Kimmel to Letterman. Short will tell you that confidence is the most important factor in any good performance. And it's likely what kept him on a steady rise through the ranks of improv and sketch comedy, and helped him avoid imploding from the pressures of being the new guy in the room with some of the genre's most intimidating names. Harry Shearer, Christopher Guest, Billy Crystal, and Lorne Michaels were just a few of his early colleagues. It's not hard to imagine that Short's self-possession is also at the root of some of his most precocious and obnoxious inventions. We find Ed Grimley and Jiminy Glick hysterical in direct proportion to their complete lack of self-consciousness. Short's most beloved characters are his finely observed, albeit magnified versions of people we all know. Off Camera attempts to reconcile the frenetic showman, consummate comedy student, and urbane purveyor of talk show banter. As we ask, is this guy serious? So pull up a chair and listen in.
All right, Marty.
Yes.
Thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
Doing this with me. And I have to tell you, it's a little bit intimidating having you here because you are pretty much the undisputed master of sitting in a chair across from another person talking while cameras roll. You know, I mean, I saw you on Kimmel a few months ago, and you killed it. I mean, you had him on the floor, and I don't think he was expecting it, because for a while he kept trying to go somewhere that he had prepared, and you were just killing him. And, you know, it made me wonder, like, do you prepare for a late-night talk show appearance like you would anything else?
Oh, completely.
You do?
Yeah, you do. I remember when I first started doing talk shows. It was like 1982. I'd been asked to go on Dave Letterman's show. He'd just been on for a couple of months, the old show.
Yeah, at 12:30.
Yeah, and I was in SCTV, and I would like watch the shows, and I'd think, oh, I know what it is. So the idea is that you've got to be, do an impersonation of yourself relaxed at a party or a dinner party when you're loose and you're in a role. And it's got to be manufactured because you have an audience, you're on television, and you have 6 minutes or something then. And you kind of go, but that's what you have to aim for, and you may not achieve it right away. But so one of the ways to get there is to feel confident.
Right, right.
And I always think confidence is the most important thing that fuels everything else. So if you walk out there and you know that you have some solid opening jokes, a couple of great stories, and you even know how to segue a joke that's planned, you know, into the story. You may not hit any of this stuff, but you'll walk out with the confidence of saying, I'm prepared for something, and then that confidence will create this looseness. Because ultimately the audience, especially if you're known to them, they don't care if every joke works, they just want to see you relax. They don't want to see you nervous.
Right, right.
I hope this works. You know, they don't want that.
Letterman once said about you, he said, I love having Marty on because I don't have to do any work.
Well, he and I have a long history of chatting in these chairs.
No, but you know, it's interesting. Like, I think that kind of thing is so vibey, too, because We're all funny occasionally. Everyone has their moment where it's all working. But it's kind of like magic. It doesn't, I can't
well,
make
you know,
it appear.
If you're doing a show that's edited,
yeah,
like Bob Costas used to do a late night interview show in the 90s, and their premise was you just filmed. And then he cut it down. Well, you don't have to prepare anything for that because you know, hey, you know, within an hour you're going to get 11 minutes.
Right.
But most shows, you're out. They're not talk shows. That's Charlie Rose.
Sure.
What Letterman's doing, or Jimmy, or Jay, or all those guys, are variety shows. You're there to entertain.
Yeah.
And if you look at an old Tonight Show from Johnny Carson's era, you know they would have authors on, and the conversation was much calmer, and it was less, you know. That because there was no company. Who were you going to turn to?
Right.
On the bus, there was nothing to turn to.
You turn
and
the
you had
start.
To walk across the room to turn. Remember?
Right.
That was a drag. David Steinberg, the comedian, once said to me that, like in the '60s when he was on Johnny Carson all the time, he said literally, you would walk down the street and everyone, hey, saw you and Johnny last night. Everyone had seen it.
That's all they watched.
That's all they had.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, when you were young, was there kind of a gold standard talk show performer guest that you always thought every time they were just gold?
Certainly we were talking earlier, Don Rickles. When Don Rickles was on the Carson show, I wasn't going to not see that. It couldn't VCR in those days. I was going to... Don Rickles and you know anyone, Jerry Lewis, all the funny people who were big stars. You know, when Johnny Carson first started and he followed Jack Parr.
Yeah.
And Jack Parr, who had the Tonight Show from 57 to 62, and then Carson took over. But the huge stars didn't go on the Tonight Show. Didn't go on anything. They didn't go on the Today Show. You only saw them at the Academy Awards.
Interesting.
So the accessibility of them was, it kept them kind of otherworldly. They were beyond just the mere mortals that would appear on television. And then Parr left in 62 and started on NBC a Friday night show. It was on for 3 years, just Friday, 10 to 11, prime time. And then he would get the big stars. Then people like Richard Burton would go on and stuff like that. But they wouldn't go on the Tonight Show.
What do you think changed that?
I guess it was just junkets and right. And accessibility. So suddenly, if Robert Downey is doing a movie, you're going to see him all over. But there was a time you only saw Burt Lancaster at the Oscars.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I guess going back to that Kimmel performance, it seemed like, though you may have prepared some stories and jokes, it seemed like you just went off on a very improvisational...
Oh, event. Absolutely. No. Don't get me wrong. The preparation puts you in the zone of confidence.
Okay.
The ideal is that you go out there and you hit very little of it. That confidence zooms you out to another zone. Because if, in fact, you go out there and you just hit your prepared stuff... That's not any good either. Then it looks like you're doing part of your act or something.
Right.
And the person in that chair could be anybody. Because what you want to do is create a sense of it's a real team work going on.
Right. No, it was like watching two professionals, you know, lob a tennis ball back and forth. I mean, it was
But
it was
I know
amazing.
Jimmy. We're friends, so.
Right.
So, like, after that show, we went and had dinner. And we had fun.
I also see how seamlessly, you know, you have so many points of reference. You really studied performers way back before your generation as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can go and do an impression from someone that hasn't been on television for 40 years.
Oh, people something. Think it's a brand new character.
Exactly, right.
You know, well, it's odd, you know.
Like
you,
Betty Davis.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like, what, you know, a young person watching goes, that's really funny, but I have no idea who he's doing.
But they don't even need to know. When I was a little kid, you know, we had one television in the living room. And so my parents would decide what we watch, mostly.
Right.
And suddenly I'm watching, you know, the British author Malcolm Muggeridge discussing why the little ball is such a destructive force. And I'm laughing. I'm 12. I don't quite get it, right? But I'm close enough getting it. I'm aiming higher,
right,
than me, which is good.
Do you like that live television environment, that it could all go bad in a second type thing? Like, is that something that is part of, to you, true performing?
Not really. I kind of like to do things right. And I think that there's certainly advantages to live from New York at Saturday night, uh-huh, as far as the live energy. But sometimes things happen. You know, whenever I'm on Letterman, I always perform a song.
Right.
And, but one time I was doing this song, Goodbye Al-Qaeda's Rose, a tribute to Bin Laden. And so I'm walking over, I'm talking about, you know, we've got that nasty curmudgeon, and now it's... And I go to the piano, there's no mic.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Supposed to be Elton Johning at the piano. And Paul, I just kind of kept talking and kind of looked over, and Paul just said, what is he supposed to do, play with his dick? And then we stopped. It didn't matter. We weren't live.
Right.
You know? But, so I think there are advantages to live in that it's kind of, it focuses you, it makes you know that there's only one shot at this. But if something screws up, it's a drag to have to say, gee, it could have been great, but the prop collapsed.
Right,
you know?
Sure.
So I think it's sometimes advantageous to have a second shot at something.
Right.
But, you know, in movies and things like that, I like to do 1,000 takes.
Oh, you do? So you just like to keep trying it from every angle?
Because I think it's all luck. It's all luck to get that kind of great take.
Well, that I was wondering, is it the kind of thing, is comedy for you something that you really design and shape, or is it, let's throw a bunch of stuff against the wall and see what sticks?
Well, I think it is everything, whether you're a movie or you're doing a television special or you're doing... It's all designed for the director and editor to sit there in about a month and a half and assemble all this. So whether you like it or not, whether you feel you're the most powerful human being in the world, you're really just providing different tones of paint to a painter who's going to paint his picture later on when you're not there. And it's kind of freeing if you think that way, because then you try everything.
Right.
And I mean, I've worked with directors who I didn't think were the greatest directors in the world. And I could do a scene and I'd say to myself as I'm driving home, well, look, you know what? I'm going to go and have a glass of champagne because I don't know if this film's going to be any good. And probably won't be any good because the director's no good. But I gave him everything he needed. In fact, I even weaseled extra takes. You know, could I have a freedom take? And I used my charm, and I weaseled as many. So he has everything he needs. Now it's up to him to screw it up.
I think that's an interesting perspective as an actor. You don't have the final control over your work.
You have no control.
You just give them all the raw data and hope that they
have the craft to put it together.
Whereas live television, very different thing. I know you did one season on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And I read somewhere you said that it felt kind of like final exams every week because, the time from coming up with a skit to performing it seemed so, like it happened so
quick.
And
also I think that because, you know, Billy Crystal was in that season, Christopher Guest was in that season, Harry Shearer was in that season, we all had one-year contracts. So I think that for me, I didn't even feel like, I'm kind of like this week, but that's cool. You know, I always felt, oh, no, I gotta. So it was treating every week like a special, like because I'm not going to be here for
And because there's
years.
So much talent, like, you have to bring your game up and...
Well, it's survival of the fittest. No one's saying, gee, that's a great sketch, but we don't want to use that because that actor's too heavy. No, if that actor will be heavy in the show because they're just picking the best material.
Right.
It's hard.
Did you like the environment on show night?
I've always felt about every job. I like the idea of getting the job. I like the idea of cashing the check for the job. And I love going to the rap party. And everything else is kind of, you know.
It's funny to hear you say that, because when I watch you perform, it looks like you are just having, you know, like, this is exactly what you're born to do. And I think that is one of those mysteries about comedians, because it's a lot more work than anyone ever imagines. And it can be completely not you. And there are times when you have to turn it on when it's not natural, right? And you have to be able to get there. And
yeah,
I would think that,
I mean,
live thing...
I think that it's just... You want it to be great, and you just hope that the stars line up that it will make it great that day.
Right.
But ultimately, going back to what I was saying earlier about preparation, I think what's great about preparing a lot and being focused and literally so that you can say, I did everything I could do. I'm not a robot. I'm not from another planet. If you didn't like it, well, that's subjective, but if it didn't work out tremendously well, it was not through lack of trying. That's why I was never someone that could, like, have a drink before a show.
Right.
Not because I couldn't handle having a glass of wine at dinner before a show, but it was like, what if something went wrong? You'd have to say, oh, I wonder if it was that wine.
Was it that 5% sharpness that got turned
off? Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. However, when things don't work out perfectly, I don't beat myself up. I kind of go, you know, look, I did everything I can. So, and then coding all that is that I do love to perform.
You do?
I do love performing. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun in the moment. And you feel great afterwards, especially if you do a stage show. You feel physically fantastic. It's like you're filled with a sense of accomplishment. You've done a workout, you're a little sweaty, and, you know, you're ready for a steak and a beer.
Do you think that partially is in your nature of, and in maybe anyone who wants to perform for a living, is you're always kind of searching for an audience to love you, and, like, is part of it that, is part of feeling really great after a successful performance, is that that's an element that you really respond to and kind of need after a while, or
no?
Not for me.
I think for a lot of people, yes. But not for me. I think if I were a dentist and I did a complicated mouth and it turned up beautifully, I'd say, all right.
You know,
wash
be weird
my equipment and get me out of here. You know,
it'd be weird if you became a dentist now, because then someone would come
that'd
in.
Be cool. I thought that'd be
and
cool.
They lay down and their last thought before the gas is, wait a minute, this is Martin Short.
I used to think it would be very cool. I've passed the mark. But when I thought, when I turned 50, wouldn't it be great to go back to school? Because at one point I was going to be a doctor. I was in pre-meds.
No kidding.
For 2 years. That I realized it wasn't, I didn't care about science. I was just a fan of Quincy, you know, and that's not enough to get you there. I like the idea of being a doctor. But anyway, I thought, wouldn't it be cool to go back, become a doctor. Now I'm 55, and I'm practicing. And I go to a small town, I'm Doc Short.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at 85, I'm dead. And then kids would be walking home and say, do you know what I heard? That old Doc Short used to be an actor. I thought that would be much cooler than, you know, being 74 and sitting in a room with a bunch of 74-year-olds on the new Roseanne show as the neighbor,
yeah.
You know. you know,
you think that's
memorizing your line.
You.
Are you going to finish that? Are you going to finish, you know. But I do think, getting back to what you said earlier, that for me, a friend of mine once said that I'm one of the few people in comedy that it's laughing on the inside. So in other words, I this is not through love me.
Right.
I need your love. I don't need the admiration of strangers. Usually if an audience doesn't respond to you, it's because your material's not any good. but if it is good and they're not responding, I'm capable of saying they don't get it.
You are a very well-balanced, well-adjusted guy. And like I read that Lorne Michaels said he'd have you back on his show now and that you're such a hard worker. You have an aesthetic... in some ways, like my father's generation of work hard, gain satisfaction from that, and don't worry so much about
it. I don't think I ever figured a way, to be quite honest, how to do it in another way.
Mm.
I mean, I do think that, and you know, it wasn't like, you know, I was in Second City in Toronto, and some of the greatest work that any of us did was all just in the improv set. So there's no work in that. You're just improvising.
Well, you've had a real talk show and a fake talk show.
That's correct.
Which one was harder?
Well, the real talk show was, I like talking to people. I made it, you know, I was doing SCTV and Saturday Night Live. I was doing everything. Usually the host comes in and he has a meeting with the staff and they tell you who's on the show. And I'd be in the makeup chair being made up as, you know, Irving Cohen, the songwriter, because we were about to shoot a piece there. And then, so I was doing a lot.
Yeah.
I was making,
yeah.
I was ambitious.
Well, yeah, I think on your talk show, too, it wasn't a traditional talk show. There was aspects of you as a performer as well. And I was like, I don't think Martin can do just a straight talk show. Like,
well, you know, I think it's important to, whatever you're doing, to create a signature. Jimmy Fallon's done that brilliantly, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. he's not doing a traditional talk show now. He's doing a mix of Saturday Night Live and his love of music and talk and his playfulness. And that's why sometimes... there's in the second segment Robert De Niro playing Password.
Right.
So it is, I think that the mistake that happens if people don't try to carve their own signature, doesn't mean it's going to work or not, but it means at least it exists in the ether as a piece of art.
Right. What was your initial impulse or inspiration to do Glick?
I was fascinated by... Because when I was doing this talk show, this is 99-2000 for King World, they hadn't really sold it properly. They probably should have sold it more, and then we committed to do it.
Right.
But everyone said, let's just do it. So we were all over the market. We were on at 2 in the morning. We were on 11 at night. We were on 11 in the morning. We were on 8 in the morning. And so I was, and we had lots of, you know, daytime there for, placements. So I started looking around at daytime television. I hadn't watched daytime television, and I couldn't believe the level of some of the people who were clearly the boss, but they were morons. And
right.
they had this power. They had all this. There was an assistant scared he screwed up the lunch order, and to me it became so. Jiminy was not a satire of. You know, journalists would say, oh, I guess you're getting back for all those years we've made you. I thought, no, the journalists have been nice to me. I've no agenda with journalists. It's morons with power. This is not tuna fish.
Right.
And I had ordered. Suddenly this, you know, ass is reprimanding someone about that he should be getting the tuna fish. So that to be, Jiminy could have been, I mean, a genius job of Jiminy would have been, if I were still doing that, I would have moved him from show business, and he now would have run, and he'd be representing the fine state. You know, he'd be in Washington working with John Boehner. And that would be good. Or a dean of a school, you know.
Right, right. I mean, some people have also said that it's, you know, you obviously have this reputation of a well-adjusted, nice, gregarious, generous person, but that Glick was maybe a way for you to... say things you wouldn't normally say or take it right up to that line. Did you ever feel that way?
I grew up in an Irish household. My father was Irish from Crossmaglen, County Armagh, and there was sarcasm, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I remember going over to... He was raised in a bar that still exists, Short's Bar in Crossmaglen. And I remember was making a movie in London, and I'd go over to Ireland and if I had a long weekend, and I'd sleep in my father's bedroom because it was the same bar. His father went from his father to his brother, Paddy. And one night, two of Paddy's sons, Oliver and Patrick and I, cousins, stayed up till about 4:30 and talking about family and drinking. And then around 9, I came down bleary-eyed and Paddy was cleaning out the glasses. And he said, so how did the character assassination go last night? And so I grew up in the world of sarcasm and funny, and that's a lot of Glick. And but, you know, Jiminy never went after the obvious things. Like, if you were interviewing a fat actor, he wouldn't say, why are you so fat? That would be horrible.
Right.
But he could say to Steven Spielberg, when are you going to do the big one, the one that connects to the people? Or to Mel Brooks, what's your big beef with the Nazis?
Right, right.
That's fine.
Right. And did you find that, I think the one that really blew me away was Alec Baldwin, because he seemed as prepared and on parallel.
A lot of that was, Alec was almost atypical, because a lot of people I knew, and so they felt safe and they just knew that what the premise was. Alec, you know, we'd do a couple of passes.
Uh-huh.
And after the first pass, Alec said, why don't you ask me about women? Ask me about a whole bunch of different women. So he had an idea. And so the premise was that I'd say, do you know Barbara Boxer? Had her. So every woman I would mention, he'd had.
Right.
You had Barbara Boxer. What do you want me to do? She's knocking at your door at 2 in the morning saying, I got to get in there. I mean, you respond. Diane Feinstein did it. So exactly. That, but it was his idea.
It was.
Yeah.
Before, because you didn't know him going in, right? Like you knew some of these other guys.
I'd met him, but I didn't know
right.
him.
Right. Was there ever intimidation on that? Like, was it more nerve-wracking to do someone like Alec than doing someone you'd known for a long time?
I don't know if the word is nerve-wracking. Obviously, if you're doing John Lovitz, you know, it's different. But Alec, I knew, you know, we have a lot of mutual friends. I knew that he was a great guy.
And
I knew he'd be playful and loose, and
right.
and he came in with lots of energy, and he was a, you know, he loved the Glick character. It was pretty easy. I mean, I don't think that there was particularly times when I'd get nervous, because also, it wasn't live. It wasn't
right,
live.
Right.
You could always just...
You're doing a long stretch of a show, and you're in that character for a long time. At some point, do you start answering as him? I mean, is it... You know, they say when you really know a language, you dream in that language.
Oh, no. It was not that as much as, you know, it was all improvised, Jiminy Glick. And so I must admit, it was bizarre when I would see the tapes back and I think, boy, I've really lost myself in this guy. Like, I'm using expressions that I've never used. I take great umbrage. I've never used that.
Right.
I'm quoting random people from, you know. And so I think on that level, it was kind of, in a way, fascinating for me.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that you'd be in there for so long and you'd finish for the day. Was it kind of like a process to get out of it?
No. In fact, I would, you know, we'd break for lunch and I'd take the fat suit off and I'd have a bathroom, but I'd still have the face. And forget I had the face on, and I'd be talking to someone. And it's like when years ago when we did SCTV, Rick Moranis was the only single guy in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be like a beautiful actress, you know, on the show, and he'd like go over and, you live in Toronto a long time? And forgetting that he had, like, one eye up here and a bald pate, because you forget.
Right,
you're
yeah.
in for so long, you just forget it.
Once you decide, okay, I'm going to do this character, I'm going to create the show, do you workshop him or Woodshed at home
no,
alone
no,
a lot?
It changes. I remember the first time I did Jiminy Glick, it was during the talk show.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought, oh, this is a great way to get more celebrities on the show. You can go to a junket. You can, you know, and to create your own... man on the street kind of thing, but it's you. Normally it would be someone else you'd cast, but it would be me. That's good.
Was there a freedom of them to answer to Jiminy that they'd say things that normally they wouldn't say?
Well, I don't know. I always would tell, you know, people would... I remember Steven Spielberg, who's an old friend of mine, would say, you know, he hadn't done a talk... Well, he'd done my talk show.
Right.
In 99, and now this was 2001, he was doing Primetime Glick. But the reality is the only other time he'd ever done a talk show was Dinah. Back in the 70s.
He doesn't,
you know, you don't see Steven showing up and anywhere. And so he was a little, he said, how do I play? What do you want me to play? I said, just pretend that you're doing a junket and a guy's come in and you just have to go with it. He's a powerful guy, but he's a moron with power. And so you don't do anything. I mean, just respond as if, Steve Martin, I remember we did one, and he, in Goldie Hawn too, and they would,
they really treated Jiminy like, Goldie would say, oh, Jiminy, you're so wise, but you always have been. Remember, Tom Hanks came on and Tom said, you know what, Jiminy, I miss? Your daytime show, your old daytime show.
So he would give you...
And in the world of improvisation, you can't deny anything.
Right.
Because if I say, I never had a talk show...
It's dead.
Dead.
Right.
And so I just... Oh, I miss that show, too. We did it at the Beverly Garland Hotel, and she would come in the stupor and ask us to leave. Now it was... That was part of Jiminy's history. Now he had a daytime talk show.
What is going on that very moment in your mind when he throws something at you? Like do the wheels start spinning and you're like,
oh. I think...
Or is it just all within the character and you just...
I think you're just in the character and it just rolls out.
But that's something that's... I mean, you prepare your whole life to be able to do that.
I was actually... When I was first approached to joining Second City in Toronto, when it came to Toronto, mm-hmm. I had... it was the spring of 73 and... A whole bunch of us had done the show Godspell for a whole year. Gilda Radner and Eugene right. Levy and Paul Schaefer, all those guys, and Dave Thomas. But now, Second City, and they were all excited. Gilda was excited. And I did an audition for it because I thought, you know, fear, obviously. But it was also this idea of, I've always been kind of a funny guy, but now to be funny under pressure, oh, I don't know if I want to do that. So I waited a couple of years before... joining it. So I finally joined in 77 mm-hmm. in Toronto, and it was amazing that you could just be in the scene playing it kind of real but with attitude, and suddenly things would come out of your mouth and you wouldn't even know why the audience was laughing. And if you heard a tape back, because they used to do audio tapes back then, now they do videotapes, you'd hear and say, I get why that would be funny. Or you'd say to someone, why did they laugh there?
Yeah.
Well, because your reaction was so kind of nothing, and you know what I mean? It was just like, now you're in a role, and you're just... And so I realized with improvising, you could just speak. And because you didn't have to do jokes, you just speak.
And back to that confidence thing.
Yeah. And the more that works, the more you become a little...
Right.
What happens with Second City is that people leave, and then they come back a couple of years later, and the cast will say, oh, we're so thrilled you're here. Would you come up and do the set, the improvisational set? And if you say no, then you let more grass grow, then you never, ever go again because you're now scared.
I would think it'd be like if you were a motorcycle racer or something, if you walked away for 6 months, it'd be that much scarier to go back and go up to full speed.
I think it's, you know, for me, I always, you know, I don't tour as much as I'll book concerts, and I like to do a couple a month. It always keeps me, you know, because again, they don't care if every joke works, but they'd like to see that you are loose and that they can walk away and say, well, I don't know, I felt like I had a hang with that guy.
So comedy's a muscle for sure. It's something that
confidence.
And when you is there a lot of solitary time in the preparation where you just kind of have to go in a room by yourself and work stuff out? Do you tape it? Like, what's the process for putting together a show like that, like a concert?
You know, it's chunks, and it's a board, and it's cards, and you move it around, and...
Okay.
It's that. And then, but I like to, that hour before, just kind of focus, go over my script, go over the stuff, practice in the mirror, but I don't want to be talking to people about a ball game or something.
Do you ever test it? Do you ever... bring someone to see it before you take it out or try out material?
No, the audiences tell you, you know?
Yeah.
When they're booing, you respond.
But I guess what I'm asking is, if you've got, say, a whole new bit or a whole new something, a character, something you've worked on, do you test it someplace before you take it live?
Well, it would depend. I wouldn't take it live to New York City.
Right.
but if I was in a friendly atmosphere and... a low-pressure atmosphere venue, and I could say to them, hey, by the way, I'm trying this stuff out, so if you don't like it, don't hate me. I'm working. Just let them in on it. You know?
Yeah, you mentioned Godspell, and obviously that cast of that one production, every single one of those people went on to amazing fame. And
Andrew Martin just won the Tony Award.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
One of the things that's kind of legendary about that is how... you know, you took a few more years to go full force at it, while other people just took off and went. And I read something about there being a moment where you questioned yourself and watched the success of Bill Murray and the success of, you know,
right,
people that had gone off to New York and everything. And I wondered at that moment if, because you said earlier, you said something about, you know, maybe I'll go to med school, maybe I'll do this. Did you have a plan B, or did you, were you practical about it, or was it?
I was very practical about it.
You were.
I knew right away that the likelihood, I wanted to be successful.
Okay.
And I wanted to have money. I wanted to be able to take my kids on vacation. You know what I mean? I didn't want to be struggling and broke at 38. So when I knew instinctively that the likelihood of success was so remote, but I knew that at the age of 50, I wanted to be able to look in the mirror and say, well, maybe you should have tried being an actor. Oh, yeah, that's right. You did try being an actor and you were unsuccessful. Oh, that's right. Okay, good. But at least I checked it off. And so what I did when I left, I did 4 years of university.
Uh-huh.
And then before embarking in a master's in social work, I was now a social worker, which was my plan, I went to, I took a year off. And it was like, I was doing plays, and it was so obvious that I should do it. The answer was right here, but I was looking around. I talked to all my professors, what do you think? All my siblings, what do you think? And I gave myself a year. And I thought, if I can't make a living in a year, then I'll go back to school. And if I can, I'll be open to renewing my contract with myself.
Really?
Yeah. So I kept renewing it. I'm still renewing it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Was there a point when you felt like, okay, I belong in a room with anybody, I made it, I'm successful? Or do you still feel like you're renewing that contract?
Well, I don't think I'm renewing the contract as much as, but I don't feel like I did it.
No. You don't?
No, I don't think anyone does. There's no one. I was interviewed once by someone who asked this same kind of question, but said, you have to, but didn't quite, it was hard for him to swallow that I didn't feel that. And then I said, you think Larry David walks around feeling like he owns
right
LA? And he said, he has to some degree. He does. And next day I saw Larry and told him that. This is the craziest thing in the world. Are you kidding? I don't even know why I even have enough to pay for this dinner, you know. People are working, as long as they're working, on what they're doing right now. And they're filled with the same apprehension, the same questioning. Do I have the ability? Will it work? Am I over my head? Why did I take this on? If I only had a magic button, I could press and undo this whole decision. To me, it hasn't changed since Godspell.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, I was thinking about that, how, you know, there's the saying, life is short. But the truth is, life can feel really long when you have to keep on kind of one-upping yourself or finding new ways to, you know, do your thing and make it, you know, make it viable.
And I think you want to keep, if you're interested in something, then it's a whole new thing. Tom Hanks has done a play this year, the first play in his professional career, let alone the first play on Broadway. And there's no one really more successful or more famous than Tom, but this made him feel like a little kid.
You know, it's funny, I'm sure also there was that irrational fear of, what if they finally find out that I can't do this as well as people think? Or I'm sure it's somewhere.
Well, I think everyone worries about it. I don't believe Tom worried about that.
You don't think so? You think he's...
No, I think he... In that particular case, in Tom's case, I think that he knows how good he is. Maybe he doesn't know as good as he is, but he's won 2 Oscars in a row. But you're also worried about is this going to be a disaster? I mean, will I forget my lines?
Right.
You know, all those things are normal.
Sure, like you said, with
the
improv
thing. By the way, you forget your lines. Everything you worry about happens, and no one knows or cares because they don't know what the play is.
Right. You just have to have a a way back, right? Yeah. You have to have a back door if you forget
your limit. The first show I did in New York was a musical, The Goodbye Girl, with Bernadette Peters. And Neil Simon, you know, would be, he wrote it, and he would be there every day of rehearsal and every preview, as the playwright is, and he would say, that line doesn't work, try this line. And he'd say, well, how about this line? Because he's always writing lines. And so I'd have it written all over. And
he said,
do you think you should can try one more tonight? I said, sure. And it would make him laugh. So he'd laugh so hard. This is insane. You're going to forget everything. No, I'll be fine. But what would happen is that you'd remember the new lines, you'd forget the old ones. And sometimes you just go blank because your brain is too busy thinking about the new lines coming up. And whenever I would go blank during previews or something in Chicago before I went to New York, I would then just start making up stuff. And then I'd look over Burnett, and she was completely hysterical because she knew that I had forgotten. And it's not that these lines didn't make sense. It's just she found it hysterical, and that's, of course, what the audience loved the most.
No kidding. So you didn't feel like you were throwing her under the bus like, oh, God.
Oh, I had no, I didn't even know she was on the stage. I was trying to survive. I couldn't remember what I was supposed to say.
Do you remember a time ever when it just, everything failed you on stage? And
there was one when I was doing a show, this is now 7 years later, Little Me on Broadway. And in the previews, I did freak myself out for two shows in a row by thinking, because I'd play nine characters, there's so much I had to learn, and thinking, gee, I hope I don't forget. And even this kind of running conversation was happening as I was doing scenes. And I was like, and at one point I did blank. But it lasted 12 seconds, but it seemed like it was 12 days.
And then, and it's that thing where you're like, I'm never going to get it back, right?
You can't imagine it. But somehow someone says something and you're back.
I had Judd Apatow on here. And we talked a little bit about his high school radio show where he interviewed comedians. I remember when he sat down with you when we did our photo shoot, and he had actually called you and interviewed you when he was very young.
Yeah, he sent me a picture.
Did you have any recollection of it whatsoever?
No.
No. You know, I listened to some of those tapes, and I thought, what a brilliant idea to say, okay, I want to be a comedian, so I will just call every successful comedian and interview them and ask all the questions I need to know. You know?
Well, this is the reason he's Judd Apatow.
Exactly.
You know?
Did you have someone that you kind of considered a teacher or someone that kind of guided you along the way?
I think my brother Michael,
uh-huh.
You know, who's a two-time Emmy-winning writer for SCTV, but he was so funny in the house, and he's 6 years older. So it was like trick. I was the youngest of five, so I just copied everybody.
Oh, really?
You know, and because I was, you know, the baby, you know, had this extra confidence, but I was copying, you know. And, but I didn't know. I didn't have, there wasn't like a teacher. There wasn't one person. Certainly, you know, as I progressed along, Eugene Levy was, again, someone, he was the one who told me, kind of pushed me to try this acting thing for a year or two. And then when I joined Second City a couple years later, it was certainly people that I would look like, Andrea Martin, Catherine O'Hara, those kind of John Candy, people who, Joe Flaherty, who were so gifted and you could learn so much from.
Just being in that cast of people.
Yeah, Joe Flaherty was a big influence. You'd learn a lot. I remember him saying, I went to this, before I was in Second City, but I was doing a workshop. And he was running it, and he kind of said, you know, you'll always get your laugh if you mime hitting your foot and saying, aw, shit. They'll always laugh. But don't you want to aim a little higher? Don't you want to try to see if you can do a little better? And, you know, something like that stayed with me my whole life.
Was there a lot of crossover and workshopping going on, like in sort of a writer's room environment? I mean, was there this kind of camaraderie of, hey, let me see if I can get a laugh in this room because it's probably the most sophisticated room in terms
I was doing SCTV.
What was that like? What was that room like?
That was a daunting room because I joined late. So they were already a hit. They'd already won an Emmy, you know. In fact, they won an Emmy. They were nominated in every category of writing. I mean, every, you know, when the Emmys are best writing for a variety show, they nominate five. They had nominated five different episodes of SCTV. So they'd already won the Emmy going to the first Emmys they were nominated. That was the quality of group. And it was, you know, again, Eugene and John Candy and Andrea and Catherine and Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas. And they were all brilliant. And it made it trickier is that I knew them. You know, they were my friends. So, but I just kind of thought, I have to jump in here. And they were all supportive and helping me and guiding me. And I knew the first piece I did, I remember I'm now at the edit bay with the editor, and I see Joe. Joe, get in here. I need your help. You know, I wasn't hesitant to ask for help either.
How long did it take you to feel comfortable?
It was fast because it had to be fast. Because what happened is that the original cast of SCTV, there were 90-minute shows, and I did three with the full cast, and then we broke for the summer, and then Dave and Rick and Catherine left. So I was now just one of five.
No kidding.
And Catherine came back for a couple of shows, but mainly it was just now I was one of five, so there was no time to just be in the background for a couple of years and then move up.
You were right there.
You had to be right there.
And was it like you were living it when you were doing it? Was it, you know, well, late nights and camaraderie and...
We were in our hometown of Toronto, so you did go home. But it was late.
Yeah.
It was late. And you couldn't blame anyone because you wrote it. So, in other words, if they said, okay, now you're shooting till 11, but you got to be back at 6 in the morning, it's because you'd written yourself something that complicated. Remember, Joe Flaherty and I particularly would always want to make sure that if you went past a certain point, they'd put you up in a hotel near the studio. And we'd always want to make that last call to have a cocktail, even though we had to get up at 6.
Really?
Yeah. And, but it was, that was a daunting group. But I found a lot of, you know, then the next year, I mean, I did SCTV for 2.5 years, basically. And then the next year, I did Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And suddenly I thought, oh, God. I mean, there was Billy Crystal, who I'd known a little bit. Christopher Guest, I'd never met. Harry, I knew a little bit. But those guys had just come out with Spinal Tap that summer. So I remember going to the movies and thinking, I can't compete with these guys. These guys are like the Beatles, you know?
Yeah. But do you rise up at that point? I mean, did you feel like when you came into Saturday Night Live, is there an atmosphere of, hey, welcome, or is it you got to prove yourself?
No. They were really, really very, very nice to me.
Yeah.
They were very nice to me because I'd already, in a way, proven myself by being successful in SCTV. It wasn't like I was this, you know, kid from a club that someone had seen once and Dick Ebersole said, I have a hunch.
Right.
They'd already seen me. That was the George Steinbrenner year. Dick Ebersole, the executive producer, who was filling in for Lorne for a 5-year period there, used to call it because it was the first time that they were paying more money. People were established.
Uh-huh.
And they were being given a year contract just because they didn't think the show was going to survive. They thought it might be canceled, so he was putting some extra steam to make sure it was successful. So there were therefore more pressure on us, of course, to make it successful.
And that was more like a variety show as well. I mean, there were more kind of pre-taped skits, and it was...
Well, you know, SCTV is a big influence that year, and so was Spinal Tap.
Uh-huh.
So pre-tapes... I remember there was... the dress did not go well of the first show. And now it was, you know, they were putting together, but we had this piece called Lifestyles of the Relatives of the Rich and Famous.
Yeah.
There was a show at the time called Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. It was
sure.
Relatives.
Robin Young, right?
Robin, Australian.
Robin Leach?
Yes.
Robin Leach.
And Harry Shearer played Robin Leach in him. And I played Nelson Hepburn, Katharine Hepburn's nephew.
Yeah.
Who was a hot dog vendor. And Christopher Guest played, you know, Charlie Callis's, he was a comedian's, you know, traffic cop, whatever. The point of it was that it was, the piece was really strong. And I remember saying to Bob Tischler, who was the producer, why don't we open with that? And Ebersol and I were, oh, no, you can't open with it. Why? Well, it's pre-tape. We open with, we have to open with a, you know, a live piece. Why? Well, because, so then they all said, no reason. And they opened with The Lifestyles of the Relatives, and it made it seem fresh, and it was, and no one cared. They laughed.
Right, right.
You know, they weren't saying, wait a second, this isn't live.
Right, just because it was established doesn't mean it had any precedent or anything. But when a show goes poorly in the dress, what can be done between that time and when you go live?
Well, traditionally, you know, it is that old thing. You want it, if it goes too well in dress, sometimes the air is a little under, and that's the worst case scenario. But I think, you know, listen, it's just, it's everyone's doing the best they can. There's no show on Monday.
Right.
By Wednesday, they're building sets, and by Saturday, there's a show. So they deliberately go into the dress with too many sketches because they know that some are going to bomb. Some that people believed would kill, the audience kind of,
And when you matched up, did you have a writing partner, or was it a kind of thing where you would come in with things on your own and pitch? Like,
you know, there are two categories if you're on Saturday Night Live. You're either a writer-performer, or you're a performer.
Okay.
And so some, like the year I did it, some Christopher and Billy and myself and Harry, I don't know, Rich Hall was in it, maybe Rich as well. They had writing credits. So that meant that when on the Monday when you meet the host, you have to be there and you have to pitch some ideas.
Okay.
Any ideas for Ringo Starr, anyone? You know, if you're just a cast member, you really don't have to show up until Wednesday.
To the read. Yeah, of course, because you're not.
Right.
And who would be the ultimate? Would be Lauren or Dick in that case would be the ultimate you know, decider of who...
Well, the tradition of that show is, because I just hosted in December, nothing much has changed in that respect, that it's the host, the executive producer, Lauren / Dick, the producer, in this case Steve Higgins, but then Bob Tischler, and maybe another writer or two, and they're in the room, and they start, the pieces are over here, and the film pieces are in a different color, and Lauren would take the card and say, well, we want that. That feels like an Act 3 piece. Let's put that there. We don't have anything to open. What else?
Right.
Marty, what do you like? Anything you liked that you really loved? Because it kind of finds its natural energy. It's not like there are 25 killer pieces and which one do we pick?
Right, you know? Right. And was there one or two guests that you felt like, oh, my gosh, this is such a cool opportunity to write for them?
Oh, George Carlin was a guest host.
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy.
And is that the kind of thing where everyone's kind of, you know, they're stepping up for that week and really pushing it, or saving material back?
Yeah, I wasn't that kind of writer. I was really just writing for myself.
You were?
Yeah. You know, I would be in two pieces a week. That's all.
Really?
Yeah.
And that was for you?
That's only because that's all I could do. And if someone else wrote something... then great, then maybe I'd be in three, but I tended not to be in that much. I
really?
Was pretty done by around 10 after 12.
Was there the most anxiety, like that year of your career, in terms of just keeping up with that schedule?
Yeah, it really was, as you said earlier, it is like final exams. I mean, you pump and you pump and you get it out, and let's say Saturday night goes great and you go to the party. You feel great. You get phone calls Sunday morning. You feel great. Why, thank you. But then around Sunday night, and you're watching TV with your wife, and maybe there's a baby who's crawling around, and you're going, Christopher Reeve's coming in tomorrow. I don't have any ideas. And then it's Monday, and you fake your way through the meeting with the host, and now it's Monday night, and you're saying, okay, I have nothing. I have nothing. I feel like the biggest failure in the world, and 48 hours before that, you felt like, I'm a king.
God.
You know? I remember Billy Crystal said one of the biggest laughs he had that whole year was that he was leaving around 5 in the morning. This is now Wednesday morning. The read-through would be at noon. He was going to try to get some hours because you could, the last time you could slip a script, because there were no more computers, you could slip a script under the door was 7 a.m. on Wednesday. And then they'd type them up, and the read-through would be at noon or 1.
So that was it.
But at 5 in the morning, Billy's knocking on my office to say goodbye, and he sees me just sitting there, and he leans around to see whatever, and it just open on.
That's all I had. Just a blank.
I had 2 hours.
Open on.
I had 2 hours.
And it was nightmare. 5 in the morning, and you'd been up all night?
Oh, yeah.
And what was there ever one that you were just like, I am going to BS my way through this and put this craziest thing down and see what happens? Or
I mean, do you remember Andy Breckman, very funny writer, and I, Jesse Jackson was the host.
Right.
And we wrote a piece literally at 6:15. Took us about a half an hour. And we knew that it would. But Andy said, you know, I don't think we're handing in anything that Reverend Jackson actually would love to do. And I had been fascinated by the word moot. I was using moot that day. So we came up with a piece and where Jackson would say some fact and his answer would be, but the point is moot.
Right.
It's all moot because blah, 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 blah. And that was the running thing. We put it in never thinking they would be picked. And of course, Jackson loved it. And it was one of the first pieces that he did on the show.
No kidding.
It was written in half an hour.
Around a word that's fun to say.
And it was only so that Andy and I would have a laugh at the read-through.
No kidding.
Knowing it, seeing it bomb. But it didn't bomb.
That's got to be a great lesson, though, about not being too hard of a self-critic.
I think it's huge in most everything. I think that people really, if I give one bit of wisdom to my children, it's just be your biggest fan. And then maybe that sensibility will catch on to others. But just cut yourself some slack and know that you're doing the best you can and you're working as hard as you can. And just be proud of that and stop worrying about, yeah, but I'm not as rich as that guy. You know.
Right. I think our kids will have an easier time of that because we learn that kind of parenting. But I came from a father who, you know, getting a compliment from my dad was like, you know, I don't know how to do that to this day. You know, it was always, you know, well, if I give him a compliment, he might slack off and, you know, so.
Well, you know, they grew up in, whether it's depressions or wars, and they were always fearful that if you made it too soft for your kids, then they wouldn't know how to work hard enough. What's very hard for a parent, as you know, is that at a certain age, you know, the ship has sailed. That's
right,
who they are.
Right, right.
You know,
which is earlier than you think, I think.
Much earlier than you think. So you might as well, you know, give your daughter that great coat she wants, because if she's 23, you're not going to now make her someone else.
That's right, that's right. How does 6 count? I think she's who she is?
No, not yet. You have time to destroy her.
Exactly. I'm working on that.
Yeah.
Do you remember when you were a kid, the first big laugh you got where you realized, hey, I'm funny?
No, I don't.
There wasn't a party or a moment where you said,
I can make my own. I just remember that laughing and being funny was a norm in the family. It wasn't like everyone was manic depressive, but I was putting on a red nose. Everyone was funny in the family. My father was hilarious. My siblings were hilarious. My sister's hysterical.
Interesting.
And everyone was funny. We made tapes really young.
Really?
Interviewing people. The Sleazy Awards, you know, for best pornographic film. I'd be like 11. I have these tapes still.
You do?
Yeah.
Audio tapes.
Audio tapes. So that was just the norm. So when I went to school, I was kind of the class clown if the teacher was weak. if the teacher was strict, I was as good as gold because I didn't want to go to the office.
Right.
So if the second the weak teacher turned their back, I was now impersonating them. But it was second nature to me. It wasn't like one day I got it.
It wasn't, and it wasn't a thing where you're like, oh, I like that, I need more of that. It was...
Well, I think you always like when people do like the funny guy.
Yeah.
Girls like them, and guys want to be their friend. Why not? It's...
Well, they're not threatening.
They're not threatening, and they're also a fun hang.
Right, right. To even go one level deeper, which what we do—that's what we do on this show.
Wow.
What is funny? Is it the bizarre in normal behavior, or is it? Do you think about that? Do you think about why is something funny and how it works?
Usually, out of sincerity comes the funniest things.
Okay.
You know, you pick up your shirts, and the guy's, I couldn't get a stain on his shirt, and he's wearing Madras pants and a bad middle that's exposed, and you go, he's not trying to be funny. He's not like on Saturday Night Live doing a character. He just lives. That's hysterical to me.
Right.
Seeing Richard Nixon explaining to America when I was 18, I don't know where that gap of the tapes went, you know, 18 minutes. But there was sweat up here that was telling us he was lying. We knew he was lying. He knew we knew. Sweat up here, looking very sincere. That was funny to me.
Right.
So I think out of sincerity, and then you can go as broad as you want because there are these people. Jiminy Glick asking the hard questions. Frank, you know, as broad as Frank was in Father the Bride.
Yeah.
I remember going to a big fancy wedding after I made that movie, and I saw that the guy was wearing embroidered loafers. I thought, missed that.
Right, right. Like, it's, you'll always
find someone would have said, oh, that's too broad.
You'll find the real thing that's more
absolutely
crazy. You know, I was thinking of that first, I don't know if it's the first sketch, but I saw the sketch you did as Ed Grimley in the job interview. Was that the first time he was...
On Saturday Night Live, yeah.
Yeah, where
I've done him on SCTV.
Okay, but it was the one where...
He wants to be in Wheel of Fortune?
No, it was a job interview, and it was yourself and you were both being interviewed, and this woman, who I forget.
Oh, that's right. That was the first Ed Grimley. Yeah, Catherine O'Hara.
Catherine O'Hara, and she's obviously
Harold
overqualified,
Ramis.
And you and Harold Ramis, the interviewer. And, you know, when you just did that dry cleaner guy, I thought, well, the start of Ed Grimley is a complete unawareness of the self.
Yes, he was. And the reason the hair went like that is that it was actually... When I said Harold Ramis because we did it at Comic Relief, and there's a tape of that in the 80s, but this was 1977, and Peter Aykroyd, brother of Danny, was the guy interviewing us, and he said to me, gee, you know, your hair's... Because I would grease my hair up a little bit to give a kind of weird look. He said, boy, that hair is standing up taller every show. And to make him laugh, I made a point.
Right, right.
And he started laughing, but the audience started laughing. I thought, well, isn't that what we want?
Yeah.
So it became a slightly piece of pop art, you know.
Well, what I find interesting about that character is that there's not any one thing. Just the way he does everything is funny. You know what I mean? Like,
well, there were no jokes. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. There's no jokes. There was no shtick, but the whole thing is funny.
It was just all odd.
It's just odd.
Yeah. And just his world, right.
Where did that come from initially?
Yeah, there always comes a little bit of something. There was a guy I knew in school who wanted to be a photographer.
Uh-huh.
His voice kind of always went like that.
A question at
so
the
I'd
end.
Say, Mark, did you take any photos this week? I took a lot of slides, but I didn't develop them because like I knew what they were, so I didn't need to see them. You gotta go, you remember that?
Yeah.
And then I don't know where I must say, but it was like a very decent to see you, I must say. It was kind of a lilt. I knew another guy kind of talking like this. So it was a little bit of him. Hair, as I told. Pants, I don't know why.
Yeah.
And then the sensibility of his world. I remember my sister-in-law, I was doing a TV series in 1979 called The Associates, James L. Brooks Show.
Yes.
And they were coming down to visit me in California from Canada. And she was about 30 then, Liz. And she said, oh, I'm so excited. I'm so excited about the trip. And I'm so excited about the flight. And I changed my outfit three times trying to figure out what to wear. And I thought, oh, I love that. I love being 30, but still with the excitement of a kid. I think that's very appealing. So that Ed Grimley, even if he was in his apartment and the phone was ringing and he'd head toward it, but before he'd answer, he'd turn out and say, gee, I love the phone. There's always such a sense of mystery.
Yeah.
Well, it is kind of true.
You could say that straight about anything.
Yeah.
But all put together, it's just funny.
And it was life-affirming. It was still, I'm an adult. You know, he wasn't a kid. He was grown up.
I read that you, in the Vanity Fair article, that your late wife, Nancy, used to want to talk to Ed occasionally. Now, was the,
yeah. So she would say, I'd say, no, I don't want to go to that thing. I don't want to go to that thing. It's going to be boring. Marty, please. It's just, I told her when we go. I know, but it's just, can't we stay in? She'd say, you know what? You're boring. I'll never come. I want to talk to Ed.
Oh, Miss Nancy, what is his problem? He's, you know why? Because he's afraid of competition. It's a sad, pathetic thing. She'd say, I agree with you, Ed. Well, I agree with you.
Now, right. And were you, you were communicating.
Yeah.
That way.
Completely.
I think that's fascinating. And that was valid for her.
Well, she was part of the joke.
Right, but at the same time, it's like, you know, I could see...
She was having both.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's great to have an argument, especially when truth is in the air. I remember one time we were going to this country club, and I didn't want to go again. And I said, you know why we're going to this? We're going to this because your mother never put you in country clubs. So now because of your childhood, she said, you know what? You can go fuck yourself. And then we both went hysterical because she knew it was complete archery. I had nailed it.
Right, right.
Yeah. It could have been Ed saying that.
You know, I think also in a marriage, you get to the point where, you know, you can say those things. And with each year that passes, you can, you know... You've established some ground, and you could take another little step further into it.
Oh, absolutely. You're together 36 years.
Yeah. I read that you were originally offered the part on Broadway with Nathan Lane on The Producers.
That's true.
But turned it down.
And
yeah. And I correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason given was that you didn't want to uproot your family.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had done Broadway twice before runs, but... One was The Goodbye Girl, and they were little kids, and I could we could, you know, lift them and move them. One was a 5-month run, smaller run, which was Little Me, which the kids could jump. But already now they were, my daughter's in high school. You just can't keep saying Papa's got to work again. And with The Producers, it was, you know, even with The Goodbye Girl, it was a 6-month commitment. The Producers, you had to do a year commitment, which does not include rehearsal and does not include out of town. So you're saying goodbye for a year and a half.
Right.
And if your kids, if you're not going to uproot your kids, so you're going to now live over there where your family, who, by the way, also need a father, are at ages that they need dad in the house, and it is a family. And it, so it didn't seem like even something of a possibility. And believe me, Mel did just fine. Matthew was brilliant.
Yes, he was. But you know, I admire that so much because that was a huge opportunity, and it turned into a huge thing.
Well, it was, but keep in mind, we didn't know it was going to be the biggest hit in Broadway of the last 50 years. Right. Maybe I would have said, to hell with my family.
Yeah. No, but I think that, you know, it brings up, especially when you think about that being a year and a half commitment, it's very hard to be a great dad and... Someone who, like, it's a hard balance, and I admire that.
I think that you can do it easier if you have a great partner who is manning the ship when you're gone. And that's what I always had. You know, listen, my wife was committed to raising the children, and she'd been a surgeon and saving lives in Bangladesh, it would have been trickier for me to maybe take that movie or do that play or do Little Me on Broadway.
Sure.
When I won a Tony for Little Me in my acceptance speech, I said, I want to thank my wife for raising the kids while I went to Orso every night with the cast. You know, basically it was true.
Well, listen, it's the kind of thing that it's a huge sacrifice, because in this career, you don't know where your next opportunity is coming from. And to be able to say, you know, I'm putting my family first all the time. It's a hard balance.
Yeah, but I will tell you, it was not like one of those things, what do I do? It wasn't.
Well, that's just speaks it just to wasn't. The guy you are.
It just wasn't, you know. And then by not doing that, I created a Primetime Glick, which was a great, cool show to do in town. So I wouldn't have done that.
You named one of your recent shows, If I'd Saved, I Wouldn't Be Here.
That's right.
Now, I know you've always had funny titles on your shows.
Let Freedom Hum.
Yeah.
Sunday in the Park with George Michael. Sonny Von Bulow Unplugged.
I, Martin Short.
Goes Hollywood.
Yeah. But I wonder, what's the truth behind the title? You know, what's the funny behind that?
Well, there's a dash of If I'd Saved, I Wouldn't Be Here. I mean, it's not like anyone's broke, but it's not like you're doing it for nothing.
No, it's...
But it's so condescending to say to the audience. You know?
Right, exactly.
Here's the headline. I don't care about you, I'm just doing it for money. You know, that's disgusting.
And part of... I think that's part of your style of humor, too.
Well, they know I'm kidding.
Right, right.
Kind of.
I guess the last thing that I'd love to ask you is if there's anything you haven't done. Like, if you had a second life or if you had a parallel life, was there something that you'd love to have tried and put as much effort as you put into what you do?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, maybe, you know, one of these great professions like medicine. I have utmost regard for that profession. I think it's a brilliant thing to be a doctor and be able to save lives and bring babies in. But no, not... Other than that, certainly within show business, I mean, I've never directed a movie, and I've had opportunities to direct things.
What stopped you?
Didn't want to. And knowing that you had to want to do it.
Sure.
To make it successful. You couldn't do it because it seems like a good idea now, or the timing's right. You have to really... The great directors are people like Steven and Marty Scorsese, these guys who were 11 and, you know, making little movies.
Exactly.
I was that age, but I was up in my attic performing and pretending to have my own television show. So it made more sense for my journey, but, you know, not the other. I like working with a director where you just free up and you're going to another planet and he looks at you and says, okay, the first part's great, the second part's indulgent, the third part is horrible. So let's adjust that and maybe try this. Okay, great. And then you zen out. That's, to me, a better process of creating art than being someone who's controlling it all.
I'm very envious of that position, to be able to walk into a set where, you know, everything's kind of been set up for you to perform and you don't have to worry about anything except that.
Right. Absolutely. I used to think with Saturday Night Live, if it was just about performing material you loved and pulling it off Saturday Night, I would have stayed there forever.
Really?
It was the writing that was just, I don't have anything. I don't, you know, what can I do now?
The pressure.
Oh, horrible. Horrible.
It's just amazing to have you on here and talking to me, and especially someone like you with so much experience doing this. Thank you for coming to my little show.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, I wish you all the best. And when you want to revive Glick, we'll do it right here on
Samuel,
the internet.
Samuel, I'll be here.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.